You can't fire me, I quit. Or something like that. Sepp Blatter begins a long goodbye. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 2nd of June. Great to have you along for the ride, everybody. The ride, as it happens, is almost over for Sepp Blatter, the longtime president of FIFA, soccer's governing body, as we've all heard so many times over the past week or so, announced today that he is done. Stepping down, resigning, walking off the pitch. Choose your metaphor. To say it came as a surprise is something of an understatement. Dan Roberts is a writer for Fortune magazine. Dan, it's good to have you on.
Sure.
Sepp Blatter was just elected a couple of days ago. Why is he quitting now?
You know, he's been vague about the reason for his resignation. My bet, though, is that it was the Times report, which came out Monday night, and that fingered a top lieutenant of his, Jerome Valk, as having personally handled $10 million in bribery money. I think that's what did it.
There are many people breathing sighs of relief here. I imagine none more than FIFA's big sponsors, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Visa, all of those, who are now off the hook from making a really tough choice.
You know, they are, but it's funny. I just wrote about this today. I don't think they're off the hook from having to speak out about what's going on in Qatar. You've got this separate issue from the corruption charges, where migrant workers are dying by the thousands. And I think a lot of the people who've been calling for the sponsors to speak up are hoping that they still will and that they won't see themselves as off the hook.
Qatar has the 2022 World Cup, of course, which is why we're talking about it. Do you think this changes that at all? Could the World Cup get yanked out of Qatar?
I don't think it will, honestly. I mean, I'm very surprised that he resigned. That was a big shock. I think that came as a shock to everyone. But it would be a bigger shock if they managed to get this World Cup out of Qatar's hands. I mean, it was hard fought, hard won. And the only thing that could really do it is if there's finally sufficient attention on these worker deaths.
I saw a tweet this afternoon as this news was rolling across the internet. The head of the beast has been removed, but the rest of the body needs to be taken care of as well. How systemic do you think any reforms might be?
Well, you know, there were a number of people indicted, 9 FIFA officials, as well as a bunch of sports marketing execs that work with FIFA. And what the DOJ has said, and they've been cagey mostly, but they've said that there are more indictments to come. So I have seen people saying, you know, okay, the head is gone, you're right, but they need to make more change, you need to cut more of these footmen, and I think they're doing that. I mean, this is a big, big step toward change, and that's what a lot of people have said, is it's an organization that desperately needs to change.
As he was making this big surprising announcement today, Blatter said a couple of interesting things, one of which was all reforms are on the table. He talked about term limits, which was kind of ironic, given that he's been in office for 18, 20-something years, and also transparency, right? I mean, what else might they do?
Well, I think they need to send in some kind of organization or aid to Qatar, because human rights organizations have said that they expect something like, you know, 5,000 more deaths in time for the World Cup at these construction sites. And in addition, they need to assign some kind of outside arbiter to have objective judgment when these decisions are made. I mean, the real problem, people say, is with the structure of FIFA and the way they do their elections and the way they hand out the bids for World Cup host cities. If all of that can change, maybe that's a way for them to look as though they've really modernized.
Speaking of elections, quickly before I let you go, there's going to have to be another FIFA-wide election to replace Blatter, which means he's in office now till the end of this year, maybe early next year, right?
That's right. We think it might take as long as 4 months for this emergency council. And, you know, when you first heard that he was stepping down, I mean, my first thought was this means that Prince Ali, who was the challenger who got
from,
a few votes in the
Jordan,
election last week, might get his day in the sun. But there's no guarantee now. It's going to be there's going to be a lot of pressure on his successor. That's for sure.
Dan Roberts at Fortune magazine talking about Sepp Blatter, the soon to be former head of FIFA. Dan, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
On Wall Street today, down but just a touch. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The federal government posted some proposed health insurance rate increases on healthcare.gov last night. To be clear, they posted only companies that are proposing premium hikes of more than 10%. As a result, there has been the almost by now required political back and forth about the Affordable Care Act today. But there is something more interesting going on here, and it's happening down in the belly of the insurance industry. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports that insurers increasingly have incentives to bring price stability to their business.
Back in the day, the pre-ACA day, insurance premiums were crazy. In 1 year, sick people buying their own insurance could see a 39% spike. But if you were young and strong, almost nothing. Insurers can't divide customers like that anymore, says industry veteran Jay Silverstein. Now, they set one price for everyone on the individual market.
When you have one big pool, you have to price towards making sure that you're retaining as much of your book of business and attracting new people in. So ultimately, you have to be very good at managing cost.
The better a company manages those costs, the more stable the premium. But it's tricky, right? Companies must factor in expensive new meds and new customers. And Silverstein says consumers have more choices.
If a company comes out and says, we have a 20% rate increase, I have the chance to shop and enroll with a new carrier.
Under Obamacare, any company looking to increase premiums by more than 10% must post that publicly. Joel Aria, a former insurance commissioner, says public scrutiny pushes insurers to a middle ground.
When I was the Pennsylvania insurance commissioner, I told carriers that I would want to hold a public hearing on rate increases over 10%, and I got mostly rate increases less than 10%.
Aereo says eventually insurers will figure out how to run their businesses with more price stability. He shrugs. Does any company out there want to be known as that company with the giant price spikes? I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We're going to talk about aviation a little bit later on in the program, but the next time you find yourself cringing at the cost of a plane ticket, consider this. Horse owners have it worse. Every year, thousands of horses travel by air, both domestically and internationally, and it ain't cheap. Triple Crown hopeful American Pharoah is expected to touch down today at MacArthur Airport on Long Island, and then he'll make the 40-mile trek overland to Belmont Park for the race on Saturday. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has more now on the business of flying horses.
When it came time for Mirsad Matanovic to send his racehorse, Metaboss, from L.A. to Kentucky for a Derby prep race, he had a decision to make. Send him on a 72-hour road trip or put him on a plane? For Matanovic, the choice was simple.
We don't want to put the horse on a van to go clear cross country, especially that caliber of a horse. No way.
Instead, Metaboss flew the horse equivalent of business class. Two slots in a stall that holds three horses. Lots of legroom. Well worth the $8,500 price tag, Matanovic says.
Those are better seats than sitting in between two people going clear cross country.
He used Equair Shipping, which ships 500 to 800 horses a year. Rachel DeBert is co-owner. She says they've sent horses to Singapore, Malaysia, all over Europe, Saudi Arabia. Most expensive these days is Australia, DeBert says, because there's a lot of quarantine involved.
So for that, you're probably looking at about $20,000 a horse.
Shipping to Europe from the U.S. bare bones is about $5,000. And what does a horse get for that kind of money? Alfalfa, on demand.
And then they get complimentary water.
Katie Schroeder owns Equiflight. She says horses get jet lag too, so just like with us, water is key. KLM transports horses, often with people.
So it looks like it's the back of the plane. But then when you open the door thinking you're going to the restroom or something, it's actually a whole row of horses back there.
You might only know it by the smell before the AC kicks in on a hot day. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
If you get sick, you go to a doctor, right? That's not always possible and frequently isn't possible at all for people with mental health issues. So 30 or 40 years ago, these things called ACT teams were set up, ACT teams. Psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers on call 24/7 to help the severely mentally ill live on their own. That is, not in institutions. There is now an updated approach. Alisa Roth reports on an ACT team that aims to keep mentally ill people not only out of the hospital, but also out of jail.
Jesse Harrison's parents used to have to call the police to get him to come out of his bedroom.
Mind if we follow you up there?
So it's something of a triumph that he's taking us up there himself today.
Okay, we come on back? You got a light on back here?
I got a light in the room.
Okay. I'm following Rob Weissman, who's Harrison's psychiatrist, up to the attic where Harrison's room is. The light doesn't work, so it's dark in here, but I can see a twin bed on one wall. It's unmade.
You don't want to mess with your nebulizer.
The nebulizer for his asthma medicine is on the floor in front of the TV, along with a bunch of old styrofoam cups and other garbage.
You got to get you cleaned up in here, huh?
Harrison has schizophrenia, and he also smokes a lot of marijuana.
I want to talk about the medicine that we give you. We give you that long-acting injection?
Yeah.
Yeah, is that working?
Yeah.
How does that help you if it does at all?
I'm really doing well since then.
Mm-hmm. Does it make you feel less anxious?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been not wanting to harm myself or anything like that.
I know. It sounds unlikely that a man who spends months at a time hiding in his room needs a whole support team to keep him out of jail.
He's not a hardened criminal or a gangbanger. Happens to live in a very bad area, though, in the city, and is at risk because of his drug use. And when he does go out, he's involved in some card games and a little bit of gambling, and trouble can find him.
You need a complex team to keep people like Harrison on track. They're doctors, nurses, social workers, employment specialists, and they meet the clients where they are, literally, in houses, on street corners, or even under bridges. Harrison's psychiatrist is part of what's called a forensic ACT team. This one is out of the University of Rochester. Its job is not just to figure out how to treat patients medically. It's understanding why they keep getting in trouble with the law.
Is it driven by their addiction? And if so, how so? Are they selling drugs?
That's Steve Lombardi, another psychiatrist on the Rochester team.
Are they appearing drunk in public? Is this somebody with DWIs and that's their channel into the criminal justice system?
Lombardi's team has just finished collecting data for a study to see how well their program works. Early results suggest their clients spent less time in jail, less time in the hospital, and were more engaged in their outpatient treatment. But whether the program is saving money is a more complicated question. In the short term, Forensic ACT, or FACT teams, are expensive.
If you're running a clinic and you hire a psychiatrist, you could either get that psychiatrist to run a FACT team, which has on average about 50 patients, or you could get the psychiatrist to see outpatients, be more like 1,000.
It seems like in the longer term, though, the money you save on hospitalization and incarceration should add up. An earlier study suggested that traditional ACT teams did save money by keeping people out of the hospital.
The cost savings aspects of assertive community treatment programs may have changed.
Eric Slade is a health economist at the VA who has studied ACT teams. And he says in the early days, psychiatric patients were often hospitalized for years, which was incredibly expensive. Nowadays, it's rare for people to stay in the hospital for more than a few days or at most a few months.
To the extent that public agencies are expecting savings from assertive community treatment, that assessment may need a reevaluation.
Then there's the question of how long somebody like Jesse Harrison will need his intensive support team. I asked his psychiatrist, Rob Weissman, about that.
A success for Jesse, I think, is getting him mobile, moving him out of his attic room, getting him to seek medical care as well as accept mental health care. And to try to minimize or what we call harm reduction related to his substance use.
All of that will probably keep him out of the hospital and out of jail. What remains to be seen is if it'll save any money. In Rochester, New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They had a couple hours off and they went down and they played and they came back 2 hours later with $1,000. And I was like, wow, that's like how to earn a living as a musician.
Making sweet, sweet, lucrative music in the New York City subway. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 28 points today, about a 0.1%, closed at 18,011. The NASDAQ down 6 points, 0.1% there as well, ended things at 5,076. The S&P 500 lost 2 points again, a 0.1%. Triple header finished at 2109. Apparel maker PVH put on 7% today. It reported better than expected quarterly results and raised its full year forecast. Ralph Lauren or Loren, I get it wrong every time, and I do read those tweets where you guys tell me what I'm doing. Anyway, up 2.8%. Abercrombie & Fitch gained 3.7% today. Health insurers, well, they ailed. Cigna shed 1.2%. Aetna slid 1.9% lower. Pharmaceuticals flopped. Vertex, though, spiked 1.5% down. Biogen down about the same. Eli Lilly wilted 1.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department lets us know what the trade deficit was in April. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. And the Chicago Blackhawks and the Tampa Bay Lightning compete in the first game of the Stanley Cup Finals. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Okay, so back to aviation. Flying commercial today is, as we all know, a drag. The lines, the security, the overhead baggage wrestling matches, and then you get to spend a couple hours up close and personal with your kneecaps. That can make it tough to appreciate what's happening, though, that you're inside an aluminum tube 30,000 feet in the air that could be taking you basically any place. Mark Van Honecker is a senior first officer with British Airways. He flies 747s for BA, and his new book about his job and about the wonders of aviation is called Skyfaring. Mark, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
This is an amazingly poetic book, which makes sense in that it's about flying, but it's also, in a way, about your job. I mean, you're writing lyrically about your profession.
Yeah, I wrote this book to share with friends and family and maybe a few of my passengers why I love my job, essentially. You know, airplanes are among our most beautiful creations. You know, they're the best example of how form follows function. In this case, the form follows air, and that turned out to be a lovely thing.
Has it always been airplanes for you? Has that been your thing?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I had a whole set of model airplanes on my ceiling. I always went to air shows with my parents. I was always a little upset that there weren't more civilian airplanes there. I think they're just beautiful, and I'm really happy to be flying the one I dreamt I would fly someday.
You talk a lot about the scale of travel that we do today. Whether we're business people or flying for pleasure, we go to bed in one place and we can wake up halfway around the world. And that to you, even still now, after a career flying, is a remarkable thing.
It is. I mean, if you pick a city on the front of the globe and a city on the other side and imagine the distances between them, geographic but also historical, linguistic, and cultural— and the plane connects them. It takes people and ideas and goods and awareness between those places. You know, that world of possibility is built into, it's built into how we think of the planet. It's built into modernity itself, really. But that doesn't mean it's not amazing or that we should, treat it too casually.
I was going to ask you how you deal with jet lag, right? Because, you wake up in London and you go to sleep in Tokyo and it's 14 hours in between and it messes with your body clock. But you write more about this thing you called place lag. What does that mean?
Well, place lag is the best term I could think of for the kind of experience we have when we take a long-haul flight. There's a kind of shock, when I fly to Singapore, the last hour of the flight is quite busy, and then we go through customs and immigration and get our bags, and suddenly we're on a bus, I'm suddenly off duty for the first time, in 16 hours, and I look around, and it's just a regular afternoon in Singapore, and everybody's going about their business. It's all these people doing all these things that they would have been doing if we hadn't flown there. There's this sense that planes show us that the whole world is going on at once. And when we fly between places, we're confronted with that. It's a kind of wonder. Like jet lag, I think it's something we won't ever get used to. And that's probably a good thing for retaining that sense of magic.
I'm a big one, as regular listeners know, of reading the acknowledgement section of books and the thank you section of books that authors write. And the very last line of your acknowledgement is to three people, Silas, Anjali, and Lola. And then you say, I hope that someday you can visit the cockpit during a flight as kids could in the old days. And I remember doing that. And it's just, it's really just a shame that that can't happen anymore.
It is a shame. It is a shame, I agree. But it's a fact of the world now. And one of the things that's really surprised me, my book was actually published a couple of months ago in the UK, and I've had a whole bunch of letters from kids. And I didn't expect that. I wasn't writing the book for children specifically or for early teenagers. And I think kids love looking either up at planes or down from them. And the things that amaze children are usually a good guide to what we as adults might want to rediscover.
It's a book called Skyfaring by Mark Van Honecker. Mark, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
The old quote about the real estate business, of course, is that it all comes down to location, location, location. The same is definitely true for street performers, musicians in this case in particular. Marketplace's Tobin Lowe now on the folks who try to make a living and maybe make it big by performing on the New York City subway.
Of all the sounds you expect to hear in the subway, this is probably not one of them. But today, in Grand Central Station in New York, there it is, the didgeridoo. There's also a little bit of rock and roll. Some samba. And a little jazz. These are the sounds of musical groups auditioning to be part of Music Under New York. It's a program run by the city's Metropolitan Transportation Authority. And once a year, performers gather at Vanderbilt Hall in Grand Central Station to audition. This year, 70 performers will try out for just 20 to 25 spots. And for the groups that make the cut, there are perks.
Music Under New York musicians have the benefit of playing in front of a Music Under New York banner at specific locations that are busy locations like Times Square or Grand Central.
That's Amy Hausman. She works for the MTA. She says getting a spot on the roster is not just about how well you play, but how loud you play.
We're looking for appropriateness to the transportation environment. So we always like to say, you know, a marching band is fantastic on the field, but doesn't sound so great in the subway system.
Volume is a big deal. Legally, a musician can perform anywhere in the subway without a permit. But there are rules about noise and amplification that can get tricky. And sometimes the police get involved. But Music Under New York groups don't have that problem. It's why Daniel Duke's jazz ensemble decided to audition, even though they've already been performing in the subway for years.
I think in a way it's cool that they're supporting that in a more official channels, because we don't like dealing with, you know, when the cops come and kick us out or give us tickets or stuff like that. It really messes up our day and our vibe.
But for a musician, the program is about more than just not getting hassled. It also means dollars. Alex Steiermark is one of the judges for Music Under New York. He's also a music producer who has hired some of the performers out of the program. He remembers a particular recording session where the musicians used their break to go play in the subway.
And they had a couple hours off, and they went down and they played, and they came back 2 hours later with $1,000. And I was like, wow, that's like how to earn a living as a musician.
Sure, there's a dollar value to playing in those high-traffic subway stops. Everyone has to pay the bills. But for many of these musicians, the hope is that their next big gig might come from one of those very subway commuters. In New York, I'm Tobin Lowe for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which J.P. Morgan Chase joins the 21st century. A bank executive said at a conference today that the company is going to start phasing out voicemail for some of its employees, which I get, I suppose, cell phones and email and texting and all of that. Here's the kicker, though, and maybe this was just me. J.P. Morgan is still, I guess, paying $10 per month per employee for corporate voicemail. Seems kind of steep. I don't know. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 28 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ down 6 points, a 10%. The S&P 500 lost 2 points, again, a 0.1%. Coming up tomorrow on the program, me and the President of the United States and an interview about free trade, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the global economy. It's a new thing we're doing called Conversations from the Oval Office. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavalan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow from Washington, everybody. Have a good afternoon. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.